This is Positive Parenting. Parenting expertise and advice from best-selling parenting author and national newspaper columnist, Mr. Dad, Armin Brott.
Welcome to today's Positive Parenting Show on the American Forces Network. I'm Armin Brott. Today's show is made possible by U.S. Legal Forms. They're the number one provider of forms on the internet, and they've got exactly what you need, whether that's a will or a trust or anything else. uslegalforms.com/MrDad. From the moment our kids set foot in kindergarten, the homework cycle begins, and it grows more intense with every year. Whether your child is 5 or 15, homework can cause immense tension in the family. In this part of today's show, with the school year barely underway, we are going to be talking about homework. In our first segment, we're going to be talking with a clinical psychologist who's been working in the field for 35 years, and he's really somebody who's moving the homework debate into new and important territory. He's coined a new phrase, which is the homework-trapped child, which he applies to kids who, no matter how bright they are, for some reason cannot complete their homework assignments. He's got a whole new model for thinking about homework noncompliance, and he talks a lot about why some of the things that we've all tried with our kids are actually making the problems worse. And then in our second segment, we're going to move from the theoretical to the practical, and we're going to talk about strategies that you can use to find your personal parenting strengths and then to use those strengths to help your kids get their homework done a little bit better. We'll talk about how you can identify the individual ways your child deals with homework and other stressful issues. And we're also going to talk about some powerful leadership techniques to help your child achieve success. All that and a lot more is coming up in today's Positive Parenting Show, so stay with us. I'm Armin Brott, and we're going to jump right into that when our show continues after this.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott. After this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
I don't recycle. I mean, we can just find another planet for your kids to live on, you know?
Noted non-recycler Tommy Crenshaw talks about the future.
Oh, I can totally see finding another planet that can support life when ours fills up with trash.
As an alternative to recycling?
Yeah, an alternative. So we, like, don't have to do it. Recycling. There are lots of planets. Finding one is just a matter of time.
Many people say that recycling is pretty simple and convenient. A matter of keeping select items out of the trash. A lot simpler than finding a new planet, Tommy.
Come on, there's a bunch of planets out there.
Would you recycle on this new planet, Tommy? Or just use it up and throw it away, too?
I really don't have a clue.
Log on to YouGottaBeKidding.org and learn about all the ways you can recycle. Unless you're into lame excuses like Tommy's.
Hey, recycling's just not my thing. Starting over on a new planet? Now that's exciting.
Don't be that guy. Unless you want people looking at you funny. Log on to YouGottaBeKidding.org.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Dr. Kenneth Goldberg, who is the author of The Homework Trap, How to Save the Sanity of Parents, Students, and Teachers. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Sure, I'm glad to be here.
So what is the homework trap?
Well, the homework trap is a condition that some children are in where they just persistently can't do their work. They end up getting into a trap with their parents because their parents feel compelled because of pressures from the school to get them on track. The parents are afraid they might fail if they don't get the work done. And it becomes just a self-perpetuating cycle. And what ends up happening is that the efforts to get these kids on track end up making matters worse.
And the efforts being parents doing it for them, or what are the efforts that are going awry?
Well, the efforts are, it starts with the terror that it won't get done. And then it moves into parent-teacher conferencing and a full-court press where the parents become part of the team with the school to make the child do the work. So then the specific efforts the parents take are often desperation efforts. I mean, they may involve punishments. They may involve trying to guide the child. They may involve doing the work themselves. But the one thing that gets overlooked is that the reason these children are not getting the work done is because they have what I call under-the-radar learning disorders, not necessarily severe enough to be viewed as a learning disability, but they still have factors that are making it hard for them to work, get the work done that gets overlooked. And because it gets overlooked, parents and teachers are just trying things that just are not working.
Well, how do you begin to assess whether your child has got something? I mean, we're going to be starting a new school year pretty soon, and people are going to be scrambling around to try to catch up with the stuff that they forgot over the summer. So there's going to be that little bit of a mess. And, of course, the parents want their kids to start off the school year well and stay up on their work. How do you assess whether there's a problem in the making or there is one already?
Well, you have two ways to look at it. One is to look at the most common types of under-the-radar learning problems. And they usually show in the form of problems with what we call working memory or auditory processing or attention. The child just doesn't seem to sustain his attention. And the other problem is in processing speed, and that usually manifests in handwriting, sometimes in reading speed. But you can certainly look for difficulty sustaining attention and difficulty with handwriting. And if those issues are there, they're good clues that that's the source of your problem. The other way to assess the problem is simply to put a time container on the homework. One of the problems with homework is that, unlike schoolwork, which is bound by the clock, we start school, say, at 9, end at 3, and whether you're the fastest working kid in school or not the fastest working kid, you still get out by the bell. The problem with homework is there's no bell. So one way to assess what type of problem there is to impose a time frame and then just watch the kid and see what the kid is doing, as opposed to just going all night battling. Well, you know, create a time frame, maybe 10 minutes per night per grade, and see what happens.
Well, right there, you just almost answered a question I was just about to ask you, is how much homework is appropriate? Because that's something I think that I hear all the time from parents, is the amount of homework that kids have got to do, in addition to their piano lessons and violin lessons and karate and swimming and, you know, all the other things that they're doing, is kind of oppressive in some ways. And I know that there's been a lot of research showing that too much homework actually does more harm than good.
Well, the research supporting homework is slight, and the research that shows that too much homework does more harm than good is very, very clear. The question of the volume of the homework, that's kind of a social thing of the times issue. It started back in the 50s when Sputnik was launched, and suddenly we were in a race with the Russians, and then there's been just a variety of social and political events that keep adding on homework. So there is a very active and legitimate debate about how much homework is the right amount of homework. That said, and I'm very familiar with that debate, what I look at is not just that debate in general, but what do you do for your kid now? Because there are some parents that are complaining there's too much homework, but the kids are still getting it done. And then there are other kids that are just floundering and they're getting negative responses all the time, and those are the kids that are homework trapped. And so when I say 10 minutes per night per grade, that's kind of an existing norm mm-hmm. in the field of what's the right amount of homework. I don't know if it's necessarily the best norm, but you can still start with that. If you've got a first grader, no more than 10 minutes, second grader, no more than 20, a sixth grader, no more than 60 minutes.
It
may be a little excessive, but at least it's better than into the night for hours.
Well, it's a guideline, yeah. But I mean, I think one of the challenges is going to be that not every kid is the same. And even if you only have 10 or 20 minutes, I mean, you may have a child who's absolutely focused and can sit down and get it done in 8 minutes. And you may have somebody who's distracted and who has a difficult time focusing and may take 20 minutes or half an hour to do the same amount of work. And the child is not any less bright. It's just that they have a different style of doing their homework. Do you try to change that style, or do you try to adjust your expectations around it?
Well, I think you adjust your expectations, and you acknowledge and recognize and support your child for the style he or she has. And the thing you don't do is you don't let the child be punished by working into the night for long hours when that doesn't work. You accept the fact that if the norm is 30 minutes of homework, then the child will get 30 minutes of homework done. And it may not be the entire assignment, but that, you know, one of the things they say in the people who defend homework is that it teaches time management skills. Well, you can't really learn to manage time unless you know how much time you're managing. It's as if you had a budgeting problem and the credit counselor gave you an open-ended credit card so you could learn to budget. It wouldn't work. You'd have to learn how to use the money in your pocket. And in the same way, we can't teach kids how to manage time unless we first know how much time they have to manage. And when families are battling for hours into night, the child isn't learning anything and certainly isn't learning to manage time.
You talk about how homework noncompliance is a lifespan issue. What do you mean by that?
Well, what happens is your child starts in elementary school very eager about going to school, and the child has one teacher and the stakes aren't so high, so you end up having a certain amount of conflict over homework, and maybe the assignments are supposed to take 20 minutes, so they take that child 40, and they get to fourth grade, it's supposed to take 40 minutes, it takes them 80. It's still not, you know, it gets to be a battle, but it's not the worst. Then what happens is the child gets into middle school and suddenly they have five teachers. And what you'll typically see with children that are homework trapped, and this is a real clue that this is not a motivation problem, is that for the first two or three weeks in middle school, they'll do great in two or three of their courses. The problem is they can't do all the work for all the teachers, but they have this little window where, unlike elementary school where it's one teacher, now they can do all the work for some teachers and not for the others. Eventually what happens is they stop doing, is the boom comes down on them, and then like a house of cards, they start doing the work for all the teachers. So middle school becomes very frustrating, and then by high school, you run the risk, particularly if the child is athletic, that athletic eligibility requirements will come in, and the child will, by virtue of the homework problem, get separated from peer groups. If the child has, say, played sports with friends who may have done a little better at school up to eighth grade, well, suddenly in ninth grade, all sports are high school, not community, and the child is suddenly separated. This can become a cause for children to act out, look for other peer groups, and get into things that are problematic.
Ken, we only have just about a minute left, but I want you to talk quickly about the solutions here. What do we do? How do we handle this?
Well, there's three basic solutions. One is time-bound assignments. The second is reduced penalties. And the third is a clear statement that parents are in charge of their homes, that parents are the head of their household and that teachers are the head of the classroom, and that parents should never allow themselves to fall into a position of being middle managers to the teachers. The parents right now have responsibility to get the work done or to make the kid get the work done, but they lack the authority to modify the assignment. So that's the third major step in terms of solving the problem. And it may be necessary to create a 504 plan to get this written in stone. It may be necessary to use my book or my website or something like that to highlight the points so that the school can see the rationale behind them.
And the website is?
www.thehomeworktrap.com.
Okay. Kenneth Goldberg is the author of The Homework Trap, How to Save the Sanity of Parents, Students, and Teachers. Ken, thanks for joining us. It was great to have you. And again, it's thehomeworktrap.com.
Well, thank you for having me on the air.
Thanks a lot.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
This is the story of Daniel, who was born 2 months early. He weighed 1 pound, 7 ounces. His lungs weren't ready. His heart wasn't ready. His brain wasn't ready. At the hospital, the nurses said Daniel was a fighter, and they would do all they could to help him. The doctor said even with the best care, Daniel may never walk. He may never see. He may never learn. Daniel's parents spent night after night at the hospital, watching his every breath, holding his tiny hands, and looking for signs that he was growing stronger. At home, his parents looked around Daniel's empty nursery, at the quiet toys and the still rocker, and they hoped that one day they could sit in that rocking chair and tell this story to their very healthy son. Daniel's is just one of the more than 500,000 stories of babies born prematurely last year. But there's hope for a happy ending. The March of Dimes is funding the research and programs to stop premature birth. You can help bring more babies home healthy. Learn how at marchofdimes.com. Working together for stronger, healthier babies.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott, and my guest for this part of today's show is Neil McNerney, who's the author of Homework, A Parent's Guide to Helping Out Without Freaking Out. Neil, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So just before we went on the air, you mentioned that one of your goals is to get parents to kind of see themselves as leaders, not helpers. What do you mean by that exactly? It's an interesting sounding concept, but I don't know what it means.
Well, you know, I have a 12-year-old daughter and a 14-year-old son, and I can remember, I think it was my 12-year-old daughter's first sentence when she was a toddler probably was, "I can do it myself." A lot of kids don't really want our help. And there's some kids that let us know that from the get-go. But I think all of our kids need our leadership. And I think it's just a different way of viewing what our job is. When you think about helping, a lot of times we're thinking about it's because they can't do it themselves. So if we can think about it as far as leading, helping them see this might be the best approach to deal with this type of situation.
Yeah.
A lot of times kids will be much more interested in buying into that.
You know, it's interesting because I've had this thing. I'm not sure exactly where I got it. Some personality quirk, I guess. But I've always really had a problem helping my kids when they don't need help. You know, because I had this idea that sort of along the lines of what you were saying was that if you help them too much, then they get the idea that they can't do it. And it becomes sort of a self-fulfilling prophecy that when you don't need help, we can give you a little guidance, and maybe that's what you're talking about the leadership and the a little pushing in the right direction, but not to help you to do it for you.
Right. And a lot of times when our kids are coming and saying, "I need help," they're basically saying, "Do it for me. I don't want to do it." So I think looking at it in that way. Now, leadership is an interesting thing because in my mind, sometimes leadership means that it's encouragement. Sometimes it's guidance or what I call consulting. You know, I'm one of the few people that use the word consulting when we're talking about parenting. And sometimes it's being the boss, you know, rewarding and punishing. So I think we've got to be pretty flexible on when should we just be encouraging, when we should be giving guidance, when we should be saying, okay, well, you know what, you do this, you do it well, you get something good out of it. If you're not doing it, then maybe something negative is going to happen.
Well, so when do you draw the line? How do you begin to say, okay, I know you can do this, or, you know, here's when you might need a little bit more of an explanation? I guess we're going to agree that you never get in there and do it for them,
right?
Hopefully.
Yes, although, gosh, it's so tempting sometimes just to get it done. I think it all depends on what the kid is doing, what our kid is doing. There's probably seven or eight ways that kids approach schoolwork. It's pretty much the seven or eight ways that kids approach life. Most of them aren't very effective. Some of them are effective. And depending on which one of these things the kids are using will determine which leadership skill is going to be used best used. Kind of like because a sneaky kid, you know, a kid that's being sneaky, it's really not a good idea to try to be a consultant with them. You know, telling them, you know what, you shouldn't really be sneaky doesn't do much good. So it really depends on, it's almost a bit of a matrix on what's the kid doing and then which one of these leadership skills should I be using?
Well, give us some examples.
Sure. A disorganized kid, a kid that might have AD, attention deficit tendencies, you know, or just kind of basically disorganized, they're going to benefit a lot more from consulting, from encouragement, but not punishing. Whereas they'll definitely benefit from rewarding, but they don't really benefit much from being punished because it's not something that they're doing actively misbehavior. Punishment works great for active misbehavior. But when a kid just can't get his act together, punishing doesn't tend to help. It really tends to make things worse.
So what would you do instead?
Well, a piece of it is, what help do they need? How do they need my help? And it could be more reminders, calm reminders, which can be really tough with unorganized kids. You know, saying, okay, let's look at your homework and see whether you've done it all instead of me checking it first. You know, I'm not a big fan of parents checking the homework without the kid being right there. So doing things with them, not doing things for them, because they need that assistance more than like other kids. Like a defiant kid, a kid that's just going to say, no, I don't want to do it. You know, that's a situation where punishments tend to be most effective with defiant kids because talking to them about it really isn't going to make much of a difference. Well,
what would a punishment look like with a defiant kid?
Okay, if you continue to do this, then you're not going to get this thing that you normally get. If you continue to say no, that you're not going to do this, then, you know, one of the wonderful things about teenagers these days is that, you know, I've just moved into the era of cell phone use with my teenagers, and my goodness, it's like crack cocaine for them. That they just love having it. And, you know, if there's a defiance issue, okay, well, you know, you can choose not to do that, but then I'm going to choose to turn off your cell phone service for 24 hours. You decide. So simple things like that can be wonderful ways to say, this is the way I'm going to exert leadership here.
Okay.
And I'm just going to do it, and you decide whether you want to continue to be defiant or not.
Well, what do you do then with a child who might be, for lack of a better word, just lazy? They just don't really want to do it, and it's just not all that interesting, and it's easier to try to find somebody to help out or to do it for you.
Lazy is a fascinating word because there's something behind it. I love the idea of motivating, you know, motivation. There's a lot not motivation there. So the first piece I suggest parents do is be curious. Why is there a lack of motivation? A lot of times it's because there's just not a sense of confidence, that the kid doesn't feel confident about this issue. So trying to figure out, how can I increase that confidence? A lot of times for a kid that's considered lazy or unmotivated, it's about rewarding much smaller increases in behavior. You know, like, you know what, if you get half of the homework done tonight because you've only been doing a quarter of it before that, then something good's going to happen. For kids that are unmotivated, rewards tend to work really good as long as the reward is attainable, as long as they can actually get it.
Okay. And how do you feel about kind of guiding them, answering questions, but not actually answering the questions, or giving examples of other ways to kind of come about giving them help but without actually giving them the answer? It's such a very difficult line to tread.
It is, but I think it's something that, you know, I think as long as it's not a huge pattern, I think doing that is teaching them in a way. You know, it's okay, let's work through this. Are you getting it? Are you getting the idea? And you'll get the idea pretty quickly whether they're just kind of, you know, going along with it just so you get the work done for them. You know, I was a science major in college, and I really enjoy helping my kids with science. I was not a math major, and so I struggle with the math that my kids are doing already. You know, I forget so much algebra. But I love it when my kids ask me for help with science, because I think I can teach them things and help them see things in ways that maybe the teacher hasn't been able to show them. But it's always that fine line of, okay, am I just now beginning to be taken advantage of by their just wanting to help? Help means getting it done for them.
You know, we're just about to start a new school year, and kids are going to be coming home with homework that is, at least in the beginning couple of weeks or months of the school, it's going to be kind of refresher stuff. How do you deal with the frustration of a child who used to know something but has kind of forgotten it over the summer?
Right. One of the things I love doing in those types of situations is what I call shoulder-to-shoulder conversations, it's almost like we're shoulder-to-shoulder talking about this issue in front of us. And a lot of ways that we can do that is by, you know, isn't that frustrating? You know, that you thought you had this, and then you feel like you lost it. God, I remember, and, you know, many kids like it when we can say, I remember when I had that experience. And so being able to say, doesn't that stink? You know, isn't that lousy that you've forgotten it? A lot of times then is going to make the kid feel less bad about it, and now they're going to be much more interested in working on it. So I love kind of that sense of, yeah, I hate when that happens, when you're dealing with that.
So kind of just commiserating and,
exactly.
Yeah, it's not such a great thing. I mean, in cases like that, do you think motivation helps? I want to go a little bit further. Maybe a bribe, an outright bribe, you know, let's just get this stuff done and go out and have an ice cream.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, because then it's a reward. You know, I love rewards. And a lot of times, and this is a nuance that I think is really important for parents, and when I heard it, it made a big difference for me, is that I rarely bribe my kids. A bribe basically is, here's the reward, now I hope you actually do the behavior.
Right.
A reward
right.
is, you know, here's the thing after you've done it. And so that's a great idea. You know, doing a little bit of commiserating, said, yeah, you know, this is a bummer that this is happening, but let's knock it out. Let's see if you can knock it out. If you can knock it out in the next hour, then we'll go after dinner out for some ice cream, or, you know, you'll be able to watch your favorite show tonight or something. But a lot of times it's more motivating after you've done that commiserating.
Exactly.
They feel like it's normal. They don't feel like they're being a loser because they're not getting this.
Neil McNerney is the author of Homework, A Parent's Guide to Helping Out Without Freaking Out. Neil, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
When I have an asthma attack, I feel scared.
It's like tiny nails in the air poke my lungs.
I start to cough. Sometimes my parents have to take me to the hospital.
Today, one out of 13 children suffer from some form of asthma, accounting for nearly one-third of all emergency room visits.
I feel like I'm choking.
It's kind of like an elephant is on my chest. A little whistle sound comes out when I breathe.
But while your child may suffer from asthma, asthma doesn't have to make your child suffer. There are simple ways you can prevent your child's next attack. To learn more, call 1-866-NO-ATTACKS. That's 1-866-662-8822. Log on to www.noattacks.org or call your doctor. Because even one attack is one too many.
I feel like a fish with no water.
Brought to you by the EPA, the Ad Council, and this station.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. You know that school has already started because I'm getting questions about backpacks, and here's one of them. Dear Mr. Dad, school just started this week, and already our 10-year-old son's backpack is so heavy he can hardly lift it. I see a lot of other kids with Wheatley packs. Should we get one for him? Overloaded backpacks are responsible for an increasing amount of pain, injuries, and emergency room visits. National School Backpack Awareness Day is the third Wednesday in September, but I think the American Occupational Therapy Association, which created it, should move it a month earlier so that parents can be aware of their kids' backpacks before the school year starts. The easiest solution for the problem is to try to get two copies of all textbooks, especially the really, really heavy ones, one to keep at school, the other at home. If the school won't allow that, check into digital copies. A lot of publishers these days are making their books available for iPads and other tablets. Let's start with Wheatley backpacks. They may seem like a really good solution to the problem, but before you buy one, consider this. A recent study compared the posture of kids with wheeled backpacks against those with regular ones, and the Wheatley kids were actually more asymmetrical, meaning that they were leaning to one side, and were putting a lot more stress on their spine by twisting than kids with traditional packs. Wheelies have to still be lifted to get them in and out of cars and up and down stairs, and because of the wheels, it's tempting for kids to put even more stuff into them than they would with a regular pack. Some schools have also banned them. They scuff floors and chip concrete and ding up walls. They also cause traffic jams in hallways, and because they're below eye level, they're major tripping hazards. So, wheelie or not, here are a few important guidelines. First of all, the pack should not weigh any more than 10% of your child's body weight. The recommendation used to be 10 to 15%, but a recent study found that even 10% compressed the discs in the back and caused the spine to curve unnaturally. If the backpack makes your child lean forward to carry it, it's too heavy, no matter how much it weighs. It's also too heavy if your child struggles when putting it on or taking it off. The pack itself should be made of sturdy, lightweight material and have two thick straps. Thin straps can cut into the shoulders and cause pain or even pinch a nerve. Load heavier objects so that they'll be closer to your child's back and leave personal items at home or in a school locker, assuming that it has an actual lock on it. Lift properly. That means bending the knees, being right in front of the pack when you're picking it up, and using both hands. Yanking a heavy object with one hand or from the side puts way too much pressure on the spine. Wear it properly. Wearing a pack over one shoulder may look kind of cool, but it can cause short and long-term neck and back problems. If the pack has chest or waist straps, use them. They help distribute the weight of the pack more evenly. The pack should also be worn so it sits between the shoulder blades and not way down on the lower back. Stow it properly. Some backpack-related injuries are the result of kids tripping over them, as I mentioned before. Finally, if your son complains of tingling, numbness, or pain before, during, or after wearing the pack, have him stop wearing it completely until his pediatrician can examine him. Hey, did you know that you can listen to podcasts of this show and most of our other shows by going to MrDad.com/radio? You can also send us your comments or suggestions right there.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Studies confirm kids who read better do better in school and life. How can you tell if your child is getting good reading instruction? Here's some things to look for. Good teachers with strong credentials in reading instruction and schools with solid professional development programs. Classrooms with a balance of whole group, small group, and one-on-one instruction. An interesting array of books and magazines in school and classroom libraries that will interest kids in reading more. All children can be taught to read. Schools just need the right teachers and resources to make it happen. Brought to you by the International Reading Association, we teach the world to read.
Dear Mom and Dad, one thing I've learned in the Army is that when you're lucky enough to get a little time off, you should put it to good use. So I'm taking a moment to write and tell you that I'm fine and doing well. We have good days and bad days over here. We try to remember the good ones and get through the bad ones as best we can. Mostly we have each other, and that's what keeps us going. That and the pride of our commitment to getting the job done, whatever it takes. I miss you all very much and can't wait to get back to life as usual. Please tell everybody hello for me, that I'll be home soon. And Mom, since you asked, if anyone wants to help, just tell them to contact the USO. You can't believe how much they do for us. With love, your son Michael.
The USO depends on the generosity of the American people. People just like you. To find out how you can help, visit us at USO.org. The USO. Until everyone comes home.
There once was a boy wizard whose name was Larry Smarter.
Larry, why weren't you in Professor Dinky Doodle's mythical creature classification class?
Well, I'm taking Algebra 2 in a foreign language.
Oh, so you can talk to unicorns?
Exactly. Unless they're French.
Larry wanted to go to college, so he visited knowhowtogo.org to find the classes he really needed. Getting into college doesn't happen magically. Learn more at knowhowtogo.org.
Brought to you by the American Council on Education, Lumina Foundation for Education, and the Ad Council.
Now, get ready for more positive parenting with Armin Brott from the MrDad.com radio network.
Welcome back to the second part of today's Positive Parenting Show on AFN. I'm Armin Brott, and my very special guest for the remainder of today's show is Captain Brad Cooper, who's the Executive Director of Joining Forces. And Brad will be telling us all about what Joining Forces is. Brad, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks so much for having me.
So do tell us about Joining Forces. My little bit of knowledge that I have comes from having talked to one of the undersecretaries of state a little bit about the program several months ago, and this is basically, people have probably seen a lot of the commercials about hiring veterans, but give us some more details.
Sure. I think it's always healthy to present it in the sense of a context. And after the First Lady and Dr. Biden had traveled throughout the country over the course of several years, obviously in those travels they met so many extraordinary veterans and military families. And as you know, and as your listeners would know, you know, with less than 1% of those in our country serving, the First Lady and Dr. Biden felt as though those who have served have given so much, and that there was an opportunity for the country to give back. So about 14 months ago, the First Lady and Dr. Biden launched Joining Forces as a way to recognize, honor, and support our veterans and military families, and not just through words, but really through meaningful action. So we've had several pillars of effort, employment being one of them, as you mentioned, as well as education and wellness.
Talk about the education and wellness parts. I hadn't really known that much about those.
Yeah, so in both of those regards, in the education front, kind of have several pieces to it. We know that one of the challenges military families face, particularly those who have high schoolers, is keeping high school transcripts intact as a military kid moves from state to state. So there is legislation called the Military Child Education Compact that we've been advocating for, along with an organization called the Military Child Education Coalition, so that a military student who moves from, say, Texas to, say, North Carolina doesn't lose any credits along the way. So that's really where the education piece has been going. And to date, we have 43 of 50 states who have signed legislation that support military children.
And so that would cover somebody moving from one state to another. What about somebody who's overseas? How does that translate?
Yeah, it translates in different ways. And so my own family fit in the same category. When we moved from Germany to Tennessee, unfortunately, Tennessee had signed this education compact. So my children, who were in a DOD school overseas, moved into a public school in Shelby County, Tennessee, and all their credits transferred well. And that's the genesis of the Child Education Compact, allowing a military kid who's a high schooler to keep their full transcript intact as they move from state A to state B, including folks who are in AP courses. It used to be that a military child who was on the fast track, if you will, taking advanced credits and courses, had to, when they moved to a new state, they had to wait a year as they got assessed. And for the 43 states who signed the compact, that's no more. They can go right into an advanced curriculum.
Okay. And you mentioned that there was a wellness component as well.
There is, and we really focused along the lines of mental health. Just to give you a chronology here, back in December, we convened the leaders of the 30 leading medical association and healthcare associations in the country. So the American Nursing Association, the American Association of Medical Colleges, all with the idea of moving toward a more public-private collaboration to see where all of the healthcare providers outside of the DOD and VA system could offer value added to our veterans and military families. And then in that intervening time, we've seen several organizations step up and really deliver, particularly for veterans. Two specific examples, all of the nation's medical colleges, for instance, 135 of them, have committed to train every future doctor in the country in post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury through joining forces. Similarly, the American Nursing Association led an effort with more than 600 nursing schools and 150 nursing associations to train both the future nurses of the country as well as the 3 million nurses who are presently serving to also extend their education and have a better understanding of post-traumatic stress disorder and traumatic brain injury. And as we continue to look forward, I think we'll see more disciplines and more associations pursuing a similar path all along the auspices of having a better understanding of veteran and military family health issues.
You know, when I was working on my book on deployed fathers, I spoke with a lot of moms as well, and one of the things that came up was something I'm sure that you're dealing with, which is you talked about it a little bit from the perspective of kids having things transfer, credits transfer, but a lot of the women I spoke with and some of the guys who were the civilian spouses, they would have a certification that they'd got perhaps as a nurse or perhaps as a doctor or perhaps as a CPA even in one state, and then they'd move to some other state, and the certification wouldn't transfer. And that was something that I know that was really annoying to a lot of people, and that's something that you guys are working on taking care of, I gather.
We are. It's a huge investment, and what you've heard is consistent with what the First Lady and Dr. Biden heard literally in every corner of this country, in every trip to every base. The number one issue, I would say, is this issue of license portability. So it's any military spouse who served in a profession with a license. You nailed a couple of them. You mentioned a couple of them. It's nurses. It's teachers. It's speech therapists. It's dental hygienists. There are nearly 50 of them all told. And interestingly, as a report back in February showed, it's more than 100,000 military spouses who are impacted and who serve in a profession that requires a state license, which is, in fact, more than a third of all the military spouses in the labor force. So it's a huge population, and by virtue of them giving that same type of feedback that you've received, that it's unbelievably painful to move from state to state, the First Lady and Dr. Biden decided to take action. So back in February, they joined the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense in rolling out a Department of Defense and Department of Treasury report that talked about this issue. And in the report, it showed that it proved, in fact, that military spouses move across state lines at a rate that's 10 times greater than civilian counterparts. Not
that
a real surprise
sense.
There.
Yeah.
And it also showed and reinforce that, in fact, more than a third of the military spouses in the labor force are in a profession that requires a license, reinforcing the rapidity and real pain that's associated with renewing a license.
Yeah.
And in so many cases, the report showed, lost opportunities. In some cases, spouses wait 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months where they're not able to work, they're not able to contribute. It hits them where it impacts folks the most, which is right in the wallet.
Yeah.
And it's a loss for the community in many cases.
Sure.
When there's not a speech therapist available who can serve in the community, that's a loss for the community. So that report got rolled out in mid-February, and then the First Lady and Dr. Biden addressed all 50 governors of the nation 2 weeks later when they came to Washington, D.C., and they addressed the governors and their spouses. And this is an important point that shows just how important this issue is. If you think about the hundreds of issues in the United States of America that the First Lady and Dr. Biden could address with the American people through the governors, there's a huge range of them, but they chose to address only one subject, and that's military spouses and their licenses. Really telling of how important this issue is, and the ask of all 50 governors was that they pursue legislation and pass that legislation on behalf of military spouses with licenses mm-hmm. by 2014. And at the time of that call to action to the governors, there were 11 states who had passed legislation at that point. And there were plenty of examples, both of what states had already done, as well as examples in the report. So by no means was this an edict or a decree. States have a lot of room to maneuver to adopt legislation that they can that fits best in their state. And that's an important point.
How many states are on board with it now?
So we started with 11 of 50 back in February, so we're literally just over 4 months into this with a really concerted effort. Last week, the First Lady joined the governor of Illinois, where they became state number 23, and then a day later,
wow.
South Carolina became state number 24. And there are another six states who have legislation that's been introduced and is pending. So we've made, as I've told others, we've really made great progress.
Yeah.
I would say we've exceeded expectations, but we got to maintain the press. There's another 26 states to go, although we're optimistic that a couple of states here this summer will get the legislation through.
Seems like you've got an additional challenge, though, because you've got the professional associations, you've got the certifying agencies and that sort of thing that would have to also sign on to this, wouldn't they?
Well, they do, and that's up to the states and how they work that. And that goes back to the point of states know how best to govern themselves. They have a range of options of what they can do to help military spouses, whether it's issuing a temporary license, issuing an expedited authority to expedite the license, or, as some states have done, they take a license carte blanche. Hey, if you have Utah is a good example of that, and Colorado just last week also passed similar legislation, meaning if you came from North Carolina, if you're going from Fort Bragg to Fort Carson and you're a nurse, and you have a valid license in North Carolina, when you move to Colorado, that license is immediately good, and you can practice for up to a year with it without having to renew. So states are being creative, and they've got a lot of room to maneuver.
I'm speaking with Captain Brad Cooper, who is the Executive Director of Joining Forces. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we will continue speaking with Captain Cooper about more of what's going on with Joining Forces.
More with Mr. Dad, Armin Brott, after this, from the MrDad.com radio network.
Excuse me, do you know how to get to Maine and Maple?
Do you have these in a 7.5?
How's that cooked?
Can I get that shipped overnight?
Is there a direct flight?
How long does the warranty last?
What's your soup of the day?
How do you change the ringtone?
Does it come in blue?
Does this bus stop at Elm Street?
We ask questions everywhere in life.
Is it raining out?
What time's the meeting? How much does this cost? Does it have four-wheel drive? Have we met before?
What's my account balance?
Yet somehow, when we get to the doctor's office...
Any questions?
No.
We clam up. Ask questions.
What is this test for?
Are there any side effects?
When do I get my results?
Questions lead to better health care. Go to ahrq.gov for a list of 10 questions everyone should know. Questions are the answer. Public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to Positive Parenting. I'm Armin Brott. We're continuing our discussion with Captain Brad Cooper, who is the Executive Director of Joining Forces, where he works with Michelle Obama and Dr. Jill Biden on initiatives having to do with military families and, in particular, military spouses. What about the spouses who are not professionals and who don't have to deal with the issue of certifications? There still are a lot of issues with getting hired in the first place, because everybody who's hiring them knows that they're not going to be around for that long, and so maybe you don't want to spend a lot of time investing in training, and so they have a lot of obstacles to deal with that really have nothing to do with certifications or anything else.
Yeah, sure. So I have lived this my entire life. I'm an Army brat. I can remember my mom dealing with this, and then my own spouse has these same challenges. And I think we've really turned a corner strategically. We're doing two things. One, we're connecting military spouses with portable job opportunities that fit this mobile lifestyle that we are, and specifically through working with companies who aggregate through telework. About 3 months ago, the First Lady announced that 11 of these companies had committed to hire 15,000 military spouses in the coming years through work-at-home jobs. Great flexibility. So that's the first part. The second part is we're really working with the private sector companies around the country to hire military spouses through a priority effort called the Military Spouse Employment Partnership, MSEP. It's anchored with the Department of Defense, but it's a great public-private effort that now has 130 companies and growing in the partnership. And this partnership, in less than a year, has hired over 24,000 military spouses. So these are companies that are, one, looking to hire military spouses because they recognize the talent that the spouses bring to the job, and two, they're committing to job portability. So when a spouse in, again, North Carolina moves to Colorado, they're committing to let that job move with them. That is a huge step forward for our military spouses, and really the first of an effort that I think we've ever seen through Joining Forces, and we're looking to expand this even further, and there literally are hundreds of companies lined up to join the partnership, and people ask, why is that? What do they get out of it? They get the talent of a military spouse, and that's selling itself. I think that's a great news story.
Yeah. Well, what's going on, though, with hiring of returning veterans? Because everybody who is a veteran at some point is not going to be a veteran. Well, there'll be a veteran, but they're not going to be active duty anymore, or even in the reserves for many of them. They're going to be out needing to get a job. How is the administration working on that? What are you guys doing to help the guys who are coming back?
Absolutely. Need this is also an enormous priority, both for the administration and as a result for Joining Forces. So last August, August of 2011, the president had a series of policy announcements at the Washington Navy Yard. It was early August. One of those components of the announcement was that he challenged the private sector to hire 100,000 veterans and military spouses by the end of 2013. And because it involved the private sector, he asked the First Lady and Dr. Biden to lead the effort through Joining Forces. And at the time, we had a pretty small number of companies engaged in this process. But since then, we've expanded to more than 1,600 companies around the country who've stepped up and to date hired more than 90,000 veterans and military spouses just through this effort. And while that's a great step forward, these same companies have also committed to hire another 170,000 veterans and spouses in the coming years. So really an amazing effort that was inspired by the president recognizing the capacity to hire in the private sector and then giving the baton to the First Lady and Dr. Biden through this very unique outreach to the private sector who really have stepped up and done more. Young veteran unemployment is in a better state than it was a year ago. Although it's still slightly above the national average, the trajectory is good. We're going to continue the hard press and are optimistic that pieces are coming together and the overall trajectory in the future is positive.
Now, what's happening in guessing that there's going to be some sort of component of this program that has to do with job training, because people are coming back and there are a lot of wounded veterans, a lot of veterans who are in wheelchairs that are not able to do the same kinds of jobs that they might have been able to do otherwise. Are there programs that are going to be helping those folks who need some additional training or additional accommodation?
Yeah, absolutely. And they come in a variety of forms. Everything from the Department of Veterans Affairs on the government side, who has a program for 35-year-old and older to retrain. It provides up to a year of training to help develop a skill set to join the labor force. Two, for those who are younger, can use their post 9/11 GI Bill to seek vocational training either through a community college or programs that many companies around the country have set up, such as BAE, for instance. They're one example. They've literally hired hundreds of wounded warriors by putting them into a training program that lands them a job within the company. And quite candidly, there isn't a day that goes by where I'm not talking to some company around the country who isn't looking to do the same thing. Everyone sees the value and talent of those who have served, and they're looking to see how they can take that talent and let it best serve their respective organization. And in many cases, there's a little gap training that's needed somewhere in there, and they're willing to provide it, which is terrific.
Yeah, no, that gap training is a big thing. I mean, people come out and the skills that you've acquired and honed in the military may not apply completely. I mean, if you're an electronics tech, that's probably something that's going to do pretty well. If you've been working with computers, that's pretty well. But, you know, if you were like me, an interrogator translator, that doesn't always apply.
Yeah, I think that's an important point. And the other important part of this, there have been a whole group of folks who've really stepped up to help in that skills translation. I use the example often that even if you take a look at my own skill sets, I drive ships, I fire Tomahawk missiles, and I find submarines. Well, those don't translate well into a resume. So you really got to find, both through an IT solution and through folks on the ground who can translate those skills into readily understandable language to help the veterans get hired. And it seems to be working. It's happening, whether it's Google, whether it's AT&T is doing a great job. The VA has a tremendous site called Vet Success that does a great job. So these skill translators are really cropping up and doing a great job. In fact, there's a great Veterans Job Bank is the name of a site that has more than 1 million jobs for America's veterans on it today. It's on the National Resource Directory called Veterans Job Bank. And embedded in that Veterans Job Bank is a skills translator, so that you can put in, if you were a Navy fire control specialist, well, the truth is you didn't have anything to do with putting out fires. While that's a great skill set, what you did was repair, high-tech radar systems. This skill-embedded translator translates that and helps get jobs. It's tremendous.
That's fascinating. So tell us a little bit about your own situation. How did you happen to fall into getting away from firing Tomahawk missiles to helping people get hired?
Well, I was working in the Pentagon for the Pentagon personnel chief, and I was, like hundreds and thousands of folks work in the Pentagon. I was at the end of my tour and heading off to command, and just got a phone call and asked to get an interview process. And a couple weeks later, I had the job, and I was familiar from a policy standpoint of some of the key issues that veterans and military families had been facing, and which was very helpful as we helped take this great idea that the First Lady and Dr. Biden had started and really put incredible effort behind and helped put a little wind in the sail, which already had great movement. And you've seen through the First Lady and Dr. Biden's leadership this really take off and have a great impact.
Talking with Captain Brad Cooper, who is the Executive Director of Joining Forces, and the website that I was looking at anyway was whitehouse.gov/joiningforces. Is that the best one to refer people to?
That's it. You can look on there. You can see where to find jobs. You can see latest news around the country. You can connect and to find opportunities to serve veterans and military families. It's all there.
Brad, thanks very much for joining us. Great to have you.
Likewise. Thanks so much. It's been a pleasure.
And a big thanks to U.S. Legal Forms for making today's show possible. They're the number one provider of legal forms on the Internet. They've got hundreds of different kinds of forms in dozens of categories. uslegalforms.com/MrDad.
Thanks for listening to Positive Parenting. You can get more information on today's show and what we're working on in the weeks ahead at MrDad.com. While you're there, visit the MrDad.com gift shop with everything you need to help you become the dad or mom you want to be. Positive Parenting is a production of the MrDad.com radio network. Now, go be a great parent.